Blog Talk Radio.
From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Alaska, and on the line I have our co-host, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully.
Well, we've made it back from our three-day fleeting trip of the Pacific Northwest, and I'm back here in Alaska, and it's snowing pretty hard. Looking forward to going out and running the dogs tomorrow. What is going on in Denver?
Well, you know, it's typical Denver weather. I returned to a snowstorm slash blizzard, as the media said. And, yeah, there's probably 6 to 8 inches of snow on the ground. Woke up this morning to negative 11. And it's a balmy 25 degrees right now and sunny.
There you go. So it is a typical winter scenario going on in Denver. I know that you guys in Denver, the snow will snow one day and then be bright sunny the next, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it goes. It's what makes it difficult to run dogs here in Colorado.
So what's going on at Denver Dog Works? I know we haven't talked a lot about our business in the last few shows, so how is it going? I know you just recently got in a new dog named Larry for a 6-week board and train. What's going on with that?
Well, Larry Walsh is a rather large German Shepherd, not classified as a king, but I believe he could possibly be a king cross with a, you know, regular-sized German Shepherd. So he is quite large. He stands about 3.5 feet tall. He's going to be here for our Camp Works 2, which is a 6-week board and train program, for a couple of different reasons. He does have some separation anxiety, a little bit of unsureness, and, you know, he's a good dog. He just needs to have a refresher. He's 3.5 years old, intact male. I'm calling him Pumpkin Pie because Larry just isn't fitting right now for him. He's going to have to earn his name a little bit. Larry's kind of a manly name. Couple of other Camp Works dogs are getting ready to go home in the next week or two. And Red is a Rhodesian Ridgeback mix that we've had for 12 weeks. And he goes home on February 20th. He was here for dog aggression and just not being under control by his owner whatsoever. He has minimized his dog aggression. As you are fully aware, Robert, dog aggression is managed, not resolved, not, cured. So he's following his management program quite well. He can handle being within 6 feet or less of a small dog that is on leash. If a small dog is off leash, he's a little bit more untrusting still. But for the most part, I'm pretty pleased with where Red's progress is. Got a couple of puppies doing Puppy Works 2, which is our month-long program, and they're having difficulty with the potty training due to the insubordinate weather we have here in Denver. I mean, you just can't take little ones out when it's negative 15 and expect them to try to go to the bathroom in snow that's higher than they are. But otherwise, all the dogs are doing well.
Very good. And I know that you often work with people in these board and train programs. And if people don't quite know what a board and train program is, can you give us a quick rundown of what that is in a minute or so?
A board and train program is where we take your dog and do 90% of the training for you. And I say 90% of the training, and sometimes it's only 80% of the training. When your dog goes home, it is up to you to follow through with our training schedule and recommendations so that you and your dog can regain your relationship and he knows or she knows who's boss and what you mean when you say sit and what you mean when you say down. Consistency is the most major factor I'm seeing in dog training not working out for people. And, you know, at Denver Dog Works, our board and train is a little bit different. A lot of places that do board and trains, they'll take your dog for, 2 to 6 weeks and give your dog back to you with just one little lesson, or even possibly no lesson at all, but a video, and that's your instructions, and you're on your own. There's a few clients and a few circumstances that I've had where, you know what, the training can't stop with me and pick up them. It's just because of the position that the dog was in, age-wise, breeding-wise, and there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But sometimes you end up with me doing private lessons for you, for not just our two private follows that are included, but sometimes four and six more additional private follows are given at no charge, because I want to make sure that the relationship between the owner and the dog is correct, that the dog is doing what it's supposed to do.
So there you go. That is our Camp Works program, otherwise known as an in-kennel or boarding, board and train program. You can find more out about that at denverdogworks.com, or send us a message on Facebook or Twitter or just about any other social media outlet that is out there. Just search for Denver Dog Works in the search bar and we will pop up. So, Michelle, any other news and notes or bits and bites, as I like to call it, before we head into our guest?
You know, I just think that we need to start mentioning a little bit about your Team Aneke Iditarod Dreams segment that we usually do on Mushu Huskies, because I think we reach a few more listeners on Dog Works Radio. And I'd like you to start letting people know what's going on. I mean, I know you have a lot of followers reading your blogs, but I think that the listeners might like to hear a little update here and there about what's going on, what's your progress, what do you need? I know what you need, but the listeners might not know what you need, and some of them might be willing to, you know, put a dollar in the PayPal on the Team Aneke site to help you out.
Well, I'm not sure what we need, but I am up here in Alaska doing my best to train for the Iditarod in 2013. It is a huge amount of work, and it's a very welcome struggle that we are partaking in. I've had a great experience this season working with a long-distance mushing kennel, and we've been kennel partners since August, and it's worked out pretty good. We've done a couple of camping trips and some short races that, for one reason or another, just didn't work out well for the dogs. The dogs ended up saying enough was enough at the halfway point, but that's how it is in dog sledding. You cannot make a dog team go if they don't want to go, and I know that a lot of people don't quite understand that. They think if you hook up a team of dogs, they're going to pull forever, but the dog team is the master of that race, and if they say they're going to quit, they're going to quit. So that happens occasionally, but we're looking very forward to the teams that I'm working with heading off to the Serum Run in just a couple of weeks. The Serum Run is a commemorative for the original Serum Run, and I'm sure a lot of people know that story, where the life-saving diphtheria serum was delivered from Nenana, Alaska, to Nome by some of the most popular dog sled racers in the world, including Sepala and his dog Togo, as well as Balto. If anybody's ever seen that movie, that took part as part of the Serum Run. Of course, it was an animated movie, but it kind of told the story in a Disney version of what that Serum Run was all about. So next year, I hope to compete and complete my qualifiers for the Iditarod. It will be a 750-mile racing goal, so that will be three races, two races of 300 miles and one race of at least 200. So I'm looking forward to that. And you and I are still working out the particulars of how we're going to earn a living in the off season, whether I'm going to come down to Denver, continue to work for Denver Dog Works, or we're going to come up here and attempt to do that in Alaska. So we'll keep all of our updates flowing on that social media site as best as we can. And I do appreciate anybody that is following us with that as well. Anything else, Michelle?
You better watch out. I just might fire you.
I'm looking to be fired from one time or another. So we're looking forward to that. So let's introduce our guest, Michelle. Her name is Carol Bradley. She wrote a book called Saving Gracie. It is about a dog that was rescued from a puppy mill, and I sure do want to get some insight on that. Her name is Carol Bradley. I welcome her. She's calling in from Montana. Are you there?
I am. Good to be here.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for sitting by while we were rambling on and on about the particulars of our show, but it is a pleasure to have you on. If you will, introduce yourself. Who are you and what are you all about?
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. My name is Carol Bradley. I was a newspaper reporter for about 26 years. I grew up in Tennessee, and I worked in Tennessee and New York and Washington, D.C., before I moved out to Montana about 16 years ago. I covered an egregious case of a puppy mill in Montana about 9 years ago. A couple was coming from Alaska, actually. They were moving their puppy mill from Alaska to Arizona, and they got caught as they came across the Canadian border into Montana. They were arrested. The customs official found in the back of their tractor trailer 180 collies crammed into cages, wet, shivering, hungry, cold. And this little community wound up charging this couple with 180 counts of animal cruelty. That's not the story that I wrote about in my book, but in covering that case for the Great Falls Tribune, I really got an eye-opener into the underbelly of dog breeding. There's a lot of good dog breeders out there, as you know, but there's a side to dog breeding that I had not been aware of, where people keep dogs in cages their entire lives and give them almost no socialization, no toys, no blankets. They often don't even have a name. And after covering this case for almost a year, I really could not get this out of my mind. And I went off on a fellowship to Harvard the next fall and studied animal law while I was there, and came back to Montana still unable to stop thinking about the fact that so many puppy mills exist in this country. The Humane Society of the U.S. estimates that there are at least 10,000 substandard kennels in the 50 states. So, long story short, I decided to write a book about it, and it took me a while to do. I first started off thinking I would write your basic angry manifesto about these awful kennels. But I decided with the help of my agent that no one was going to read a book that nasty and harsh, that what I really needed to do was to tell the story of one dog who had survived a puppy mill and you know, within that story, take a step back and look at the scope of the puppy mill problem. So that's what I did in Saving Gracie. And that book is actually set in Pennsylvania because in 2006, the biggest puppy mill bust in the country at that time took place in Pennsylvania. Gracie was one of 330 dogs removed from a really awful kennel. She had lived in a cage for an estimated 6 years. And her job was to have a litter of puppies as often as physically possible. She was probably getting near the end of her lifespan. Dogs kept in these kennels spend 5 or 6 years in a cage giving puppies. When they're worn out, they are often taken out back and shot to death. But Gracie was lucky in that the local SPCA got a tip about the kennel and raided it and rescued her along with a bunch of other dogs. And she wound up getting adopted out to a woman who actually didn't necessarily even want a dog, but she had agreed to take one in because of her children. And, you know, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but I don't think it's any surprise that Gracie and Linda, her adopter, would bond very quickly. And so that's part of what the book is about.
So we are talking to Carol Bradley, the author of Saving Gracie, and she did an excellent synopsis of the book there about a lady that rescued a dog from a puppy mill in Pennsylvania. And that's intriguing stuff. And you know, Carol, there are so many stories in the news about puppy mills, and I would like to spend a little time on that if we can, since you are the quote-unquote expert on this, and we haven't spoke about this on our show before, and we've been on for over 2 years now, and I welcome the opportunity to pick your brain a little bit if we could.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'll just let you ask me questions if you want to.
All right, and Michelle will pipe in as she can. There's no way to know when she's going to ask, but when she asks, just you know, if we ramble over each other, I apologize for that. So that's the nature of being 3,200 miles apart. So my first question, I guess, or statement is: have you heard about the goings on with the kennel up in British Columbia, the sled dog operation?
Yes, that was a horrendous situation.
That was, and for people that have not heard, I'm going to give a little bit of an outline of what took place, and then hopefully you and I can talk a little bit about that and see. That wasn't a puppy mill situation, so let's clarify that a little bit. But it was a very large kennel where it got out of hand. The SPCA got involved, very similar to a puppy mill type situation.
Mm-hmm.
So what ended up happening is a dog sledding tour company was outside of Vancouver in Whistler, British Columbia, and they were offering tours to people that would come up and watch the Olympics. And they built a huge operation. They had many dogs. And, of course, as soon as, you know, all of the money and all of the spectators and clients from the Olympics left, they were all of a sudden out of business. They didn't have any revenue coming in. So they had a tremendous amount of dogs, which takes a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous amount of money for upkeep. I am kennel partners with a kennel right here in Willow, and we spend at least 70 hours a week working with the dogs by ourselves, and it is at least a $4,000 a month operation just for a very small 50-dog sled dog kennel, and we take very good care of our dogs. But what ended up happening is one of the workers there was told to kill a lot of the dogs by some very violent means. And what ended up happening is that person, I don't recall if it was a man or a woman, ended up suing the company for workman's compensation for post-traumatic stress, and got an award at some point up in Canada, and I'm not sure of Canadian law, but I'm sure it's very similar to American law in regards to workman's comp. And at that point, the story broke of this horrendous act that was taking place up there at this kennel. But there is to note that the SPCA, the Canadian version of that, had visited the kennel several times, and they said that no action was going to be taken. And even some vets came out to the kennel, and they said, we just can't put down healthy dogs. That's kind of against our code of ethics or whatever. So they wouldn't put them down. So the kennel operators were just going to take matters into their own hands and do it themselves. So if you would, Carol, would you comment on that?
Well, I think what we have happening in this country is a real divide between people who see dogs as a commodity, as a way to make a living, and people who see dogs as pets, as members of their family. I think that the situation you describe is a case where, you know, these dogs lost their economic value to this kennel owner, and he got rid of them. And in his mind, that was a business decision. I think 99% of people listening to this program would disagree and say this is horrendous. These dogs are sentient beings. They have emotions and feelings and intelligence, and it's just wrong to shoot a dog to death just because it no longer works for you as a business. What strikes me a lot about these dog breeding kennels, these large volume commercial kennels, is how many of the breeders see dogs. They will say to the public that, oh, these dogs are like our pets. They will have websites that make it look like the puppies that they breed are in their living room. You know, there's only one litter at a time. They often will dress the dogs up in cute little outfits, and they will do everything to make it sound as if they are treating all of these dogs like members of their family, when often nothing could be farther from the truth. And in Pennsylvania, the breeder that I wrote about is is not Amish, but there are a lot of Amish breeders who culturally don't understand why anyone would have a dog in their house. They see dogs like livestock, and they have a saying that with livestock comes dead stock. And a lot of the breeders in Pennsylvania, the puppy mill breeders, are Amish farmers. And that's kind of surprising to people, too. But it's, I see it as a real cultural divide. We treat dogs much more like members of our families than we did 40 or 50 years ago. And one of the estimates I've seen is that Americans have about 5 times more dogs now than we did in the 60s. You know, we have smaller households, more of us, fewer of us have kids. The dogs are our kids, rightly or wrongly. They sleep on our beds, they ride around with us, and I think as people become more and more aware that puppy mills do exist, last year I kept track of them. There was a puppy mill bust in this country about once every 10 days.
Wow.
So they're everywhere. They are everywhere, even in Montana, which is pretty remote. But people are astonished by this, and they're very outraged, and they want to do something about it. And there are things people can do. In fact, I think this problem will only go away from the ground up when people stop buying dogs that came from puppy mills. But first they have to understand that's where these dogs are coming from and make a conscious decision not to give these places their business.
Well, with that, Carol, that brings up a very good point, and I want to go on two different avenues with that. The first point is in regards to where people buy their dogs. You know, kind of the normal way of thinking, at least when I was growing up, and I grew up in the 70s and 80s, is you would go to a pet store and see all the cute little dogs and puppies in the window, so to speak, and you would pick out a dog, and you would pay the clerk at the counter, and you would take home this cute little puppy and think nothing else about it. That's where we bought our dogs from. There wasn't a huge amount of marketing or coverage of shelters back then. At least I don't recall. So we mm-hmm. went to the store to buy our dog. Who is that? You know, that song that was wrote whenever it was written, well before my time, you know, that cute little puppy in the window. So I think that a lot of people, even today, they still feel that's where they go to buy their dogs, is these pet stores. I mean, that's what they're designed for. And unfortunately, a lot of the puppy mills are getting or a lot of the pet stores are getting their dogs from puppy mills. I know there was a recent case in Denver where a guy was getting dogs from a puppy mill in Kansas, and he operated a store in Denver, and you know, he was going back and forth and got in quite a bit of trouble with that, and it raised the media awareness of puppy mills and pet stores. So my next avenue to that, before you comment, please, is what about the media sensationalism coverage of puppy mills? You know, they always make it seem so atrocious. Do people really understand that, and do people really understand how bad the conditions are, or is it just, oh, yeah, that's a news story, they blow everything out of proportion, you know, et cetera? And I'm asking you that because you're a journalist.
Well, I don't know if I can answer your question. I know that when a puppy mill bust occurs in a community, the community often is caught off guard and suddenly has to take care of 40 dogs, 80 dogs, 300 dogs, 1,000 dogs even. And it's a huge undertaking. It costs money. It, you know, beleaguers a shelter with all these dogs, the cost of caring for them until they can legally be adopted out. And I can tell you that communities that have had to go through this, they certainly know what a puppy mill is like because they do read about the conditions. You know, a lot of, you mentioned pet stores. The interesting thing is that only a third of pet stores today continue to sell dogs, you know, that have come from breeders. That's a good trend. A lot of pet stores now are, you know, opening up to shelters, letting them bring in needy dogs and cats and adopt them out from there. But what breeders are doing is getting on the internet. And like I said, you can make anything sound wonderful on the internet. And because they're selling directly to consumers on the internet, they don't even have to abide by the federal laws governing dog kennels. And those laws are weak and poorly enforced to begin with. But they're totally exempt from them if they sell directly to consumers and not to a wholesaler like a pet store. So I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, well, I'm not going to go through a puppy mill, but I have found a great website for the Sheltie that I want to buy. And I have to say to them, you know, buyer beware, because if you don't see where that dog comes from, if you don't go to the kennel yourself, you don't meet the breeder, you don't see one or both of the dog's parents, you don't know what you're getting. And, you know, we wouldn't buy a car under those conditions. We want to go kick the tires a little bit. But it's amazing the impulsive buys people will make to buy a dog that they may have for 15 years, and it could be damaged goods, and very often is. By the time you figure out that your dog is sick or you know has emotional problems, you've invested time and money in that dog, and you don't want to send it back. You live with the problems.
Right. And you made up a good point about a lot of the stores are no longer selling dogs, and in particular Petco and PetSmart down here in the States, and we have an international audience. That's why I say that. They don't sell dogs and cats anymore. I don't know if they ever did, but they do open their doors for adopt-a-thons or whatever they're called, where people can come in and look at pets that are in shelters. And I think that's a great way to not only help the shelters, but also have a great business philosophy for for the Petco and PetSmart market, which is not selling pets, but selling the supplies that you need for your pets. So I think they're doing the right thing in their business philosophy in regards to selling the pets or adopting the pets.
Yeah, I'm really glad to see that trend.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, you know, I'm listening to what you guys are saying, and you guys have to understand, I grew up with my family. We farmed livestock. We raised puppies. We were not by any means a breeder of any standard other than a backyard breeder. We bred two litters of golden retrievers while I was growing up as a kid, and that's our breeding experience. We never purchased dogs from pet stores. When we would get dogs as kids, we always went to the breeder and met the breeder, met the mom at least. If we were able to, we met the dad. I have never purchased a pet in a pet store, and every dog I've ever rescued from a kennel, with one exception, and that was our dog Aneke, we have always had problems getting dogs from shelters. What I'm hearing, though, is something that's very interesting, Carol. You mentioned that the mindset, especially in Pennsylvania, is that a dog is considered livestock. Well, a dog is considered, under Colorado definition law for the Department of Agriculture, dogs are considered livestock. Cats fall under a completely different realm, and I'm surprised that we're not discussing all the other pets that have mills out there that produce them, you know, everything from fish to cats to iguanas. They're all milled the same way dogs are, but we always are only focusing on dogs, and I understand that. But dogs are considered livestock. So how do you address the situation of puppy mills or puppy farms when people are allowed to farm livestock?
Carol?
Well, that's a great question, man. You guys are firing good ones at me. I think we are becoming more and more aware of the sentientness, that's probably not a word, but of all animals. I mean, we are starting to hear more and more about the evils of factory farming, you know. I personally don't eat veal anymore because I don't like the way veal calves are kept and isolated from their mothers. You know, I'm not real crazy about the idea of cattle being stuck in feedlots. for the last few months of their lives, and so on and so forth. The difference in some of these factory farmed animals and dogs is that a cow, a pig, a chicken all live about, well, a cow maybe lives a year before it is slaughtered. I don't know about pigs. Chickens live on average about 6 weeks. Dogs in puppy mills can be kept in a cage for 10 years.
Right.
There's a woman in my book who rescued a dog who had been, and these animals are specifically bred to be our companions. They have been domesticated.
Carol, if I can interrupt you, I think you're missing what I'm saying.
Okay.
I think what you're doing is bringing a great topic to the forefront of our communities that is not being addressed until, oh, my God, did you hear about Susie up the street? She had a puppy mill. Like you didn't know. You knew that there was a puppy mill there, but you out of sight, out of mind, until it's in your face and you're having to deal with it. I think that the problem is not going to change until the definition of what a dog is changed. As soon as you change a dog from being listed as livestock, it changes the whole realm of how people can go about doing business. In other words, the guy up in Canada had the right to treat his livestock any way he saw fit. But if the animal is not deemed livestock or personal property, but is given a certain amount of rights, as like human beings and children have rights. As soon as you say this pet does not any longer fall under the realm of being livestock or personal property, that's when you can change the laws, and that's when you can shut down these puppy mills, because otherwise you're going to have a whole bunch of people saying, but that's my livelihood.
Carol?
Yes, I agree, and that's why, you know, I used to not really understand why groups like PETA didn't like to refer to someone as a dog's owner. You know, they'd say he's a dog's person or adopter. I thought, oh, come on, we're splitting hairs here. But I understand the concept now because, like you said, if an animal is considered property, we have a mindset in this country that you can do whatever you want to with your property. And it's no one's business what you do. That doesn't really jive with the animal cruelty laws that we also have in place. When the big puppy mill bust occurred here involving the collies, Montana did not have a felony law that would address this situation. It was particularly egregious, but these people were only able to be charged with misdemeanors. And in the aftermath of that case, we now have a federal law so that if something like this comes along again, the perpetrators can be charged with felonies.
And with that, Carol, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I have one other case that I would like to mention that I want to talk about your book, if that's okay.
Okay.
All right, so we'll be right back.
At Denver Dog Works, we offer a service dog training program for individuals nationwide. Each and every service dog that is trained through Denver Dog Works and Michelle Forto and her team has an individualized training plan. Michelle trains for autistic, mobility, medical alert, and psychiatric service work. In each case, the needs of the individual are met, and training of each dog is specialized for their handler's specific needs. It takes approximately 2 years to train a service dog and takes a tremendous amount of patience, handling, and work from everyone involved, including the family members of the service dog recipient. If you are interested in finding out more about our service dog training program, please visit our website at denverdogworks.com or give us a call at 303-578-9881.
Dog Works Radio and Mush You Huskies is fueled by Native Performance Dog Food. If you want the best for your canine athlete or working dog, we recommend Native Performance Dog Food. Available at Dog Works Training Centers. Call 303-578-9881 for more information. Native Performance Dog Food.
Whether you're a Schnauzer Shakespeare or a Hound Dog's Hemingway in the making, perk up your ears.
Dog Works Radio is teaming up with animal chaplain Sid Corfee, author of the award-winning book, Good Grief, Finding Peace After Pet Loss, in presenting the Petlitzer Prize Contest, the pet-related writer's Pulitzer. Animal lovers can showcase their creative writing abilities for nifty awards and for the chance to have their works read live on DogWorks Radio. Categories range from poetry to short stories to persuasive essays and more. For more information, visit the blog page at www.goodgriefpetloss.com and click on the Petlitzer Prize link.
You are listening to Dog Works Radio. We have the best and train the rest. Now back to the show.
And you are listening to Dog Works Radio, and my name is Robert Forto, hosting from Alaska. And on the line, I have our co-host Michelle in Denver and our guest, Carol Bradley, calling in from Montana about her book, Saving Gracie. It is about a dog that was saved from a puppy mill in Pennsylvania. And we've talked for the first segment about puppy mills, the laws, different cases that that deal with this subject. And you can listen to it anytime just by following us on Facebook or Twitter or downloading the show on iTunes. Just search Dog Works Radio in the iTunes search box. So let's bring Carol back up. Carol, are you still there?
I am.
Thank you very much for sitting through the break with us, and we're talking a little bit about puppy mills, and I have another case I would like to get your opinion on if I could. It is about a case up here, literally in our backyard here in Alaska. There was a gentleman just a couple of, almost a month ago, that was arrested for running a puppy mill right here in Willow, Alaska. He had 150 husky-type dogs. He was not a dog sledder or a musher, but had dogs that looked very similar to sled dogs. And people that know what that is know what I'm talking about. And what ended up happening is the state troopers seized all of his dogs along with the animal control, and it took the guy to jail for 50 counts of animal cruelty or 70 counts, or I don't recall which, and seized all of his dogs and took them to the local shelter. And here in the Mat-Su Valley, it is a very small shelter. We're a very small community, even though it's the majority of the population of Alaska lives here in the Mat-Su Valley. So as soon as they were seized, all of a sudden the story hit, and that people were asking for supplies and whatnot because they were totally overwhelmed with all of these dogs that were going into this shelter. And one of the local newspapers here ran a story on it and set up an account at Wells Fargo Bank, and as well as one of the larger feed stores here in Palmer, Alaska. And they've ended up raising well over $100,000 just in about a month for this cause. Not only in money, but for dog food and supplies, and the local Job Corps kids built all of the dog houses. You know, these were kept outside dogs, like you were mentioning. But a tremendous amount of outpouring came from a very small community very quickly. The point I want to make is, and hopefully you can comment on both sides of this, is just like the people up in British Columbia, is this gentleman called the animal control and said, hey, I can't deal with this. He had lost his job, and of course losing his job meant he couldn't feed his dogs, and he asked the animal control officers to come out and put to sleep some of these dogs, and they did that on two occasions. But what ended up happening is he lost his job, and he began to feed the dogs, of course, that were making him the money, the puppies, and not the older dogs. He was feeding the mamas and, the breeders.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that. You know, I think not necessarily the commercial puppy mills, but a guy like this, he starts off and he gets over his head, he's breeding 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 litters a year, and he's making money, and he's selling dogs, and, he thinks he's doing everything right. He's not selling to the pet stores, but then all of a sudden, the bottom falls out, and he's stuck. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have clients. He isn't selling the dogs. Yes, it's wrong to do this as a business, but what happens when a guy gets stuck. And yes, it's still a misdemeanor up here. And yes, he's going to get a slap on the hand, and that's just about it. And then he's going to go on his merry way, and everybody will forget about it, and it'll be out of the news. But it will happen again tomorrow. So can you tell us a little bit about that in your experience?
Well, I think, you know, we have a problem with bad breeders. We also have a problem with people who hoard dogs.
Right.
And, you know, this fellow may have been a little bit of both. He can't, you know, they stop seeing reality. They don't even seem to realize that the dogs they think they have saved and are protecting are actually starving, maybe sick or injured. They're not getting treated. The breeder that I write about in my book at one time had shown dogs at Westminster, but had really gone south. And in terms of his treatment of his dogs, he claimed he never wanted to get rid of the old dogs, but he wasn't treating them very well. They were living in filth and misery, and he never did. There was a 2-day trial involving this breeder. He never at any time expressed remorse or admitted in any way that his dogs had not been totally pampered. He kept saying, you know, I feed them hamburger and cottage cheese. I really love my dogs. But it was, you know, one of the rescuers from the SPCA had to keep running outside during the raid, which occurred right about this time 5 years ago in the middle of February. She had to run outside just to catch her breath because it was just so, the fumes were just filled with ammonia and stench, and this breeder couldn't even seem to realize it. So, you know, I don't know. I think governments have to wrestle with how do you handle someone who maybe is mistreating animals and they don't even realize it. I don't begin to have the answer to that question.
And, you know, we had on about a year ago a friend of mine named Debbie Jacobs. She runs a website and a training center up in Vermont called Fearful Dogs. And she is the quote-unquote expert on animal hoarding, and we had her on, and we spoke a lot about that. And it is, you know, kind of a psychological thing that people get involved in. And you see all those shows on A&E and things about hoarders and, you know, these obsessive-compulsive disorder folks. And there's even a show on Animal Planet about animal hoarding now. And I haven't caught any of the episodes, but I saw the previews. And you know, I still think that so much of this is left in the closet. You know, nobody knows anything about this because, you know, in today's world, you know, we want to be so public and so out there, and, you know, everybody's using Facebook and Twitter and, you know, writing blogs and everything, but we also still want to be very contained. You know, we don't want the public to see how we're living and what we're doing with our families, whether it's with our kids or with our dogs. We still want to have a very closed society, but everything is only a click away on the internet. And when stories like this of puppy mills or even hoarding cases come to light, it is an outrage to everybody that sees it, because everybody sees their dog for what they are and how they treat their dogs. And like you said, 99.9% of us treat our dogs as if they're our family. We pamper them and we buy them the best food, and they sleep on our beds and on our couches, and they ride with us in the car, and, you know, they do everything that we think that everybody else does to their dogs. And that's just not the case. And in particular, dogs that, even up here in Alaska, a majority of the dogs don't go inside. They're outside. They're more like farm dogs, you know. They're guarding the property, or, you know, just being the typical yard dog. But a lot of people would even think that that's cruel, to leave your dog outside. It's, you know, we got 6 feet of snow on the ground and it's probably 20 degrees. But a majority of the public would say that guy's being cruel to his dog. He needs to be on inside where it's warm, you know, under the covers with us, et cetera. Do you care to comment on any of that? That was a little bit of a ramble, but I'm sorry.
Well, you're right. I mean, we all have different ideas about how we should treat our dogs. I draw the line at putting clothes on my dog.
I mean, I do too.
You know, I don't buy rhinestone collars. you know, in terms of pampering my dogs, I want to make sure they get enough exercise. One of our dogs is a border collie who was rescued from the Blackfeet Reservation, which is about 2 hours from here. Jilly needs exercise, and so I try to give it to her. But I don't know what to say about that. I personally like, you know, our dogs are indoor dogs, and I think dogs want to be with their families. I really wince when I walk our dogs in our neighborhood by a house where, you know, with a fenced-in run on the side of the house. The dog clearly never gets out of the run and can't even see his owner coming and going. You know, he's completely detached from this family.
Right.
I don't even want to walk by that house. And yet I realize on farms and ranches, dogs are helpers, they're workers, and sometimes they wouldn't want to be inside.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I am focusing my frustration, and which is why I wrote the book, on people who keep dogs, raise dogs for a living, but treat them like they aren't even alive. You know, just they give them no exercise, no socialization. One of the cases I write about in my book is the case of Wallace Havens in Wisconsin, who had a huge kennel. And this is a guy who designed a lot of the designer dogs. You know, he thought it was great fun to come up with cockapoos and puggles and those kinds of dogs. And he bragged about what he considered a state-of-the-art operation. Well, he decided to go out of business a few years ago, and the Wisconsin Humane Society realized that if they didn't step in, he was going to sell his dogs to other kennels. They would continue to be puppy mill dogs. And so even though he had his kennel was clean, the dogs were fed, they got water, you know, their most basic needs were met. By the time he sold them his dogs, they bought 1,600 dogs off of this guy. And in order to make these dogs socialized enough to be adoptable, the Humane Society started having volunteers come in. And this is going to sound silly, but they had these people sit on stools in the stalls, the cubicles where the dogs were, and read to them, just to acclimate them to the human voice.
Right.
Because they had been so cared for automatically, you know, automatic feeders, automatic waters. They were never handled except when they were being bred. They were scared of people, and they weren't going to make good pets. And they also installed automatic treat dispensers so that any time a person walked by, a treat would come out. So these dogs would start seeing that human beings weren't scary things. And, you know, Wallace Havens would say that he had a perfectly good breeding kennel, but I don't think so. I think the dogs he was producing and the dogs that were having to be kept behind as breeding dogs led lives of misery. They were kept in a cage. And you know, that's where I want to focus, is on people who think it's perfectly fine to leave a dog, especially a dog like a border collie that
has to run forever.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, the thought of leaving a dog like that in a cage their entire life, it keeps me up at night.
You know, that's a great point, Carol. We're talking to Carol Bradley, the author of Saving Gracie, and talking to her about her book and, you know, the puppy mill phenomenon here in the United States. My question is, Carol, is what is the right way? You know, there's millions of dogs in shelters that are there because people buy dogs or adopt dogs that, you know, they want to have for a year or two, and then they say, you know what, Max just isn't the right fit. Let's take him to the shelter and get a new one. So obviously it's a supply and demand thing here in the States, where people have this insatiable desire to have dogs, whether it's the right way or the wrong way of getting them. So what is the right way of breeding dogs? If it isn't this puppy mill operation, What about the backyard breeder, like Michelle mentioned, that thinks that they're doing it right, but they have all these problems. They're breeding the wrong dogs. Let's say they're breeding two dogs with hip dysplasia. So they're producing puppies that are only going to, you know, live well for a very short amount of time. So what do you think is the right way to get dogs to Americans? If it's not the puppy mill, if it's not the commercial breeder, if it's the backyard breeder that think that they're doing it right but they're not, how should we get dogs as Americans?
That's the $64 question.
It is.
I think that too many people are breeding dogs. I think, you know, too many families have a cute dog and they decide, wouldn't it be fun to have 8 puppies for a few weeks and then we'll get rid of, you know, we'll find homes for them. And so they breed their dog without any consideration about where the puppies are going to go.
Right.
These people are living in a vacuum. They don't realize, I mean, they honestly don't realize how many millions of dogs are already in shelters, perfectly good dogs who need a home and who are going to be euthanized if they don't find one. If I can,
Carol, just let me intersect 1 second. We do a course where we teach people how to become dog trainers, and one of the sections in that course is about kennel management and breeding. And one of the first things that we say to our students is breeding dogs is never a profitable proposition. And
exactly.
We outline how, we take it down from the beginning of the breeding till the last dog is gone. And we say, okay, you had 6 puppies. One of them, or you expect 6 puppies from a golden retriever. You know, the dog only had 5, so there goes one of your dogs. And you're expected to make $1,000 per dog, and you're expecting $6,000, just for easy argument. So now the dog only had 5. The next one, was born stillborn. The other one was returned at a year old because you had a policy that says you return dogs to the breeder because they got a divorce. The next one, had some kind of medical issue. So you go on down the line, and then, of course, the dog food, et cetera. So now this $6,000, star in your eyes, wow, it's going to be a great Christmas for the kids, all of a sudden turns into credit card debt because you've had to take care of these dogs. That's how a lot of people lose sight of this. They think, wow,
right,
we can make money, we can do this, and it becomes a very losing proposition. So I agree with you in terms of a lot of people don't have a clue what they're doing.
They don't. And, you know, we, like I said, I don't want to paint all breeders with the same brush. My husband
right.
and I, we got our first 2 dogs 14 years ago we had 2 Shelties. We got them from a Sheltie breeder here in town. I think of the world of this woman. I didn't know anything about dog. I didn't know what a Sheltie was when we went to look at this puppy. I've learned a lot since then. But I think this breeder was great, and yet she had about 13 dogs, and I don't think she ever made a dime. And she was very strict, as most good breeders are, about, you know, insisting that you bring the dog back if for any reason you can't have it, and this, that, and the other. We had to sign a contract that we would have the dog spayed, and that was fine. I think breeders like that I really don't have a problem with. We now have 2 dogs that came from, well, one was just roaming Great Falls. He's a husky golden collie mix. He's beautiful, but he's a total mutt. And then we got Jilly from the Blackfeet Reservation because we are now aware of the overpopulation of dogs and how many good dogs are in a shelter. You know, they're not there because they were problem dogs. Some are, but a lot aren't. And I am now convinced that purebred dogs are totally overblown. You know, I think there are times when you want a certain kind of dog, and I'm not going to tell somebody if they have their heart set on a particular breed that they shouldn't go find that dog from a reputable breeder. But I think for myself, from here on out, I'm going to go with mixed breeds and dogs that just need homes, that have great personalities and are going to be a great member of our family. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I think I would love to see I would love to see more and more people going to the shelter and getting their dogs. And locally, I think there is a trend in that direction. We have a new dog park. And whenever I'm there, I talk to people and say, where did you get your dog? I'm just curious. And more people are saying, I found this dog at the shelter. And they're so proud of the fact that this is a great dog. They saved this dog. So I think maybe just educating people, once they realize how many dogs exist, they're less likely to want to go spend $800 on a puppy. You know, people will say to me, well, I don't want a pig and a poke. You know, I want a dog that I can help shape. Well, an older dog is not a pig and a poke. Their personality is well established by then. And one of the Shelties we adopted after our first Sheltie died was a rescued dog in Georgia. And he had been in a foster home long enough that these people could tell me exactly what his personality was like. He was delightful.
Carol, do you have any statistics at all when you were doing your research for your book about the number of dogs that we have in America, about the number of puppy mills, any type of statistics that we can educate? We have at least 1,000 listeners every week live, and who knows how many downloads. So we can reach quite a bit of an audience right here on our little radio show. And, of course, people will tell other people, and other people will tell other people. Do you have any statistics at all on anything that relates to this story?
Well, I do. The Humane Society of the U.S. has done more than any other group to kind of quantify the number of puppy mills, and they estimate that there are at least 10,000 substandard kennels in the United States. And they define one of these as a place where a dog is kept in a cage all the time. You know, a kennel could be a clean place, but if the dog isn't getting any socialization, is not being treated in any way like a pet, in their mind, that's a puppy mill. And I would agree with that definition. The CEO of the Humane Society actually estimates there are more like 15,000 puppy mills. So the 10,000 figure is conservative. No one group keeps track of how many animals are in shelters, but there is an estimate that about 4 million dogs and cats are euthanized in the U.S. every year. That's a lot. That's a lot of pets.
That is. Do you have any idea of how many of those are adopted? You know, if they have a shelter of 50 runs. Do you know what the adoption rate is in a particular shelter? Is it high?
You know,
is it low?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, you know, you've got some no-kill shelters, and then, you know, the ones like the one here do euthanize dogs. I've never heard that figure. That's a great question.
And of course, depending on the budget, on how much they can market. In Denver, they have the Denver Dumb Friends League, which is a shelter that does put down dogs, but they do a tremendous amount of public awareness and marketing, and you know everybody knows who they are in the Rocky Mountain region, the Denver Dumb Friends League, and they
mm-hmm.
take dogs from other shelters, and it's a multi-million-dollar facility that is state of the art. It's something I've never seen. It looks like a zoo exhibit. It's so fancy, you know, where they got the fancy waterfalls and the whole nine yards. It doesn't look like your typical chain link fence shelter that a lot of people think of. So I think that education is key, as you were saying. What about, and we're going to continue on for just a few minutes, if you don't mind, Carol.
That's fine.
Going to say 30 seconds, et cetera, but we're on kind of a roll here.
Okay.
What about
Robert,
yes.
Can I interrupt? I was only scheduled for an hour, and I have to get going soon. So.
Okay, we'll let you go. Michelle, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again Friday when we have on Sid Corpy and the Petlitzer Prize.
All right. Good talking to everybody. Great show. Carol, I'll call you in a little while.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Carol, do you have anything else in regards to statistics with the puppy mills, et cetera?
Well, I can tell you that this isn't necessarily related to puppy mills, but one interesting statistic I've heard is that 90% of dogs in shelters who are groomed, who've had a chance to be groomed, will get adopted out.
Oh.
It's just, you know, being able to see a clean dog makes a huge difference to people. We're working to build a new shelter in Great Falls, and it's going to be a friendly, colorful place that people won't wince at the thought of walking in.
Right.
And the dogs are going to be clean. They're going to be groomed. There's going to be a grooming area. And you know, sometimes just even photographing a shelter dog in the right light and with the right pose, you know, waiting just a little long enough to get a smile out of that dog can mean the difference in that dog being adopted out or not. But, you know, I don't really have hard and fast figures on this, but I have a lot of anecdotal evidence about people who have bought dogs at puppy mills. The dog turns out to have an illness. It's not uncommon for a dog, a puppy, to die within weeks or months after going home with the family. And laws vary from state to state about whether you can then require the breeder to give you your money back. They will often say, well, send us the puppy back, we'll send you another one. Well, by then, you know, after a couple of days, people have bonded with their dog. They don't want to give it up. They know what's going to happen if they send it back.
Well, let me ask you a question in regards to that. That's a great point. Let's talk just a second about, you know, let's say that the puppy mill's in Kansas and the pet store is in Colorado, and you buy your dog at the pet store from, you know, Pet Place in Denver. I don't even know if that's the name of a store, but let's say that's where we buy the puppy. And it dies in a couple of weeks. But they got the dog from Kansas. So now we're dealing with all sorts of you know, legal mumbo-jumbo there. We bought the dog from Mr. Smith at Pet's Place, and he bought it from a kennel in Kansas, and, you know, it's been transported so and forth. What do you think about that in regards to how people are transporting their dogs from one puppy mill to the pet store?
Well,
it is,
I think,
you know, it's a national business. It's not just somebody breeding their dogs in their backyard, taking them down to Pet's Place, you know, and the owner of the pet store writes the guy a check for five dogs, and then they sell them for a profit like you would do on consignment somewhere with any type of product.
Well, it's a huge industry, and in fact, another reason I set my book in Pennsylvania is that puppy mills in Pennsylvania provide dogs to pet stores along the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be trucked there somehow. And, you know, everyone wants a young puppy. They don't realize that sometimes you're buying a puppy that's too young. And,
right.
You know, there's a lot of evidence that dogs, puppies taken from puppy mills to be sold in pet stores are weaned too early so that they will be 6 weeks old or 8 weeks old when they get to the puppy store, the pet store. You know, these dogs sometimes endure arduous trips along the way, and they're not cared for very well in pet stores. There's all kinds of evidence of, you know, there was a case once where a woman would wash off the puppies every day with this kind of diluted liquid that had bleach in it, you know. And she was really injuring the dogs, and their lungs were really compromised by the time they were sold.
Well, you know, one thing I never thought about until just now, and I've been doing this forever, is what happens to the dogs at the pet stores that are too old, that are 4 or 5 months old, that just didn't sell? What happens to those guys? Did you ever do any research on that?
That's a good question. There is a local store here that I can't bring myself to even look in the window of, but
right.
I'm told they keep the puppies. They will keep them till they sell if
mm-hmm.
they're 9 months old. You know, they may have spent 9 months in you know, essentially an aquarium.
The storefront, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, those cages in the store, right.
But that's a very good question. I mean, what happens when a dog gets to be 5 months old? No one has bought it. The pet store is still having to feed this dog. You know, I really don't know the answer to that question, but I'm going to hesitate to guess.
Like you said, everybody wants a puppy, and I'm sitting here looking at my 6.5-month-old Siberian. I got her when she was 8 weeks old from a dog sled kennel down in California. You know, she does not look like a puppy anymore. She looks like a mini adult Siberian. And if you know, I can just imagine if somebody were to go into a pet store looking for a Siberian and then seeing my little dog Reagan sitting there almost full size, even though she's still a very young puppy, nobody would buy her. They want the cute little, you know, roly-poly puppies that they can hold in your hand. She weighs 45 pounds,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something interesting that I just thought about. And, you know, I'm sure that I don't know if they put them to sleep. I don't know if they send them back to the puppy mill so they can become breeding stock. I don't know. But this is a huge industry, like you said, and we've only touched the tip of the iceberg in regards to our conversation. And I'm so thankful to have you on, Carol. Is there anything else? I know we didn't talk a lot about your book, but I think we made a heck of a lot of awareness about what your book is about.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, I would just encourage listeners, if you're interested in reading stories, quick accounts of people's situation with a puppy mill dog, is log on to my website, carolbradley.com. I've had people write in to say, oh, my gosh, the book you've written just sounds exactly like what I went through with my puppy mill dog. A lot of people know sometimes that they're getting a compromised dog. And they do it, they take this dog in out of the goodness of their heart. But an awful lot of people don't realize what they're buying. And they find out the hard way. And they still love their dog. But, oh, my gosh, one couple I wrote about who adopted dogs from this same kennel spent $10,000 the first year on health problems and vet bills. And, you know, I just think it's a moral issue, what we're doing to these dogs, but it's a consumer issue, too. But I have a lot of information on my website, and in the back of my book I do have some tips on how to find a good breeder. And a good breeder will check you out every bit as much as you check them out.
Right. And that's important. Don't be afraid to give out information. If you're looking for a dog from a good breeder, don't be afraid to give up that information. Now, a lot of people will say, well, why are you prying so much? You know, why do you want to know where I work and how many kids I have and what my income level is and all of these things that we've asked when we've sold dogs and we've done very little breeding with our Siberians is we want to know where they're going. You know, we don't want to send off one of our puppies, you know, to somebody that's unemployed, that has four or five kids at home, that doesn't have a car, that lives in a high-rise downtown. We want to set them up for success. So we do ask those prying questions, and sometimes people have been alarmed by that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just the openness needs to be a two-way street. And,
right.
You know, I would just encourage people to really maybe do some research into the kind of dog they're interested in. And
sure.
Boy, you get the wrong kind of dog, it can be a chore, even if you love the dog and you're not going to give it back. But
the Border Collie is a great example. You know, everybody thinks that, you know, they see that they're one of the most popular dogs in America, I think in the top 10. But until you get one of those guys home, you have no idea what you're in for.
Right.
And
Jilly,
in terms of
Jilly.
Exercise, you know, I say in my training schools, Border Collies are too smart for their own good. If you don't give them a job to do, they will run you ragged.
Jilly is at doggy daycare right now, so she can spend her energy. I'm about to go pick her up. But,
right.
Yeah, she's delightful. But I think by the time she outlives her life in hopefully in, you know, not less than 15 years from now, I'm probably going to downgrade energy-wise.
Right,
make
right.
Make her back to Sheltie.
Get a Basset Hound. They don't require much.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, Carol, so your book is available. Is it available on your website? Is it available on Amazon, at a bookstore, where?
It's on Amazon. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. It should be anywhere where books are sold.
Okay.
And the paperback version comes out in April.
All right.
So, I've gotten great feedback. It's been a very gratifying experience to write this book, because people do love dogs. They want to do what's best for them, and sometimes it's just a matter of making them understand what they're up against when they go looking for a dog. But once they know that, people want to do the right thing.
I totally agree with you. And we will have a link for your book on this show page, and it will be up there probably tomorrow once I edit out, if I have to do any editing. They'll be able to click right there as they're listening to this show, and it'll take them right to the Amazon site. That's how Blog Talk Radio is set up. We have a link through Amazon that sends them over there. So they will be able to even purchase the book right here on this show page, which is always nice for authors that are talking about their books as well. Otherwise, you can reach Carol at carolbradley.com. Do you have Facebook or anything like that?
I am on Facebook, and I do blog. So,
okay. Are all those links on your website there?
They are.
Okay, so we'll make sure that we promote that as well when we write our summaries of our shows too. Carol, anything else before we close?
I think that does it. I really appreciate the time. It's always great to talk about this issue, and I do think that the internet is helping spread the word.
I hope so. Yeah.
I hope so, too.
So it's been a pleasure, Carol. Let's keep in touch. If you have any news or announcements and you ever need to be on to promote book tours or anything you're doing, we're happy to do it, because these shows are around forever on iTunes and whatnot. So people are listening all the time, and you know how it is on the internet. We may air today, but somebody might hear it for the first time a year from now. So let's keep in touch if we can, and we'll make sure that that people get educated as much as they can about this topic.
Okay, Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. We'll talk to you very soon. Goodbye.
Okay. Goodbye.
You're listening to DogWorks Radio, part of Twine Group Media and Denver DogWorks. On Friday afternoon, we're going to have on Sid Corpy and the Pettlitzer Prize winners for round two. And then following that, we're going to bring back our Mushing Legends segment on Mushu Huskies. We're going to do that starting around Iditarod time. I know a lot of people like to find out about the mushers during the Iditarod, and that starts the first Saturday of March. So we're looking forward to that, as well as our daily updates on the Iditarod. We'll give you the leaderboard and who's winning and some insight that we may have. With me up here in Alaska, I might even get a musher interview or two. We just don't know. So we're looking forward to that. Be sure to listen to our sister show, Mush You Huskies. You can find us anytime on Facebook, Twitter, our blogs, anywhere, or download us anytime on iTunes or at dogworksradio.com. My name is Robert Forto, on behalf of my co-host who had a class to teach, Michelle, who is in Denver, and our great guest, Carol Bradley, and her book, Saving Gracie. It's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you guys soon. Goodbye.